Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is Wednesday, February 8th, 2012. Very quickly for the record, Co-Chair Winters is excused for the day. And just in case we need to, Co-Chair Nolan would be excused as well, although she may be joining us here a little later. On the agenda, we have two work session items, one regarding the Oregon State Police. It's a report on Office of State Medical Examiner costs. And then the second is with the Oregon Military Department, a report on 911 consolidation. Mm-hmm. Why don't we start off with the Oregon State Police, their report on Office of State Medical Examiner costs. And Doug, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee.
And I better open our work session.
Good point.
Let me do that really quick. Thank you, Senator. We're going to open our work session on the Oregon State Police report on Office of State Medical Examiner costs. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, this is an item that was part of an instructed in a budget note to come back and compare costs between Oregon's medical examiner system and those in terms of efficiencies, productivity, and costs with surrounding states. The Oregon system is different from the surrounding states, so I've asked the state medical examiner who's in front of you to sort of first describe the difference between a statewide medical examiner's system that Oregon has compared to a county coroner system that I believe California, Washington, I think Idaho has too. Roughly half the states are statewide systems like Oregon and half are county coroners. There are differences, but the comparisons in the study they made are between basically those systems that have forensic pathologists in them. For Washington, California, they use large cities which have, you know, large population bases and also have a process at least that is somewhat similar to what happens in Oregon. So I've asked Dr. Gunson to first talk about the differences and then talk about her work on the study.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Karin Gunson, and I'm your state medical examiner here in Oregon. First of all, I'd like to talk about the difference between medical examiner system and a coroner system. A medical examiner is an appointed official, appointed in the case of Oregon by a user group, the Medical Examiner Advisory Board. They actually recommend candidates for the state medical examiner position, and then it's appointed by the superintendent of state police. A coroner is an elected official, so a coroner does not have to have any credentials whatsoever. It's just whoever gets one more vote than the other guy, and so they don't have to have any background. By definition, the medical examiner has to be a physician, and here in Oregon, the medical examiner has to be a forensic pathologist. That's a person who specializes in autopsy medicine and violent and unusual deaths. Actually, the coroner system arose out of old English system, where they were considered to be the crownsman, and they were actually there to collect funds and taxes from people who died as a result of suicide. And the medical examiner system arises out of the foreign or the Roman legions, where they wanted to keep track of what was going around in their places they conquered, so they would send their own physicians out if there was a death in that particular community. In Washington, which I'll use as our example, they have a mixed system where some counties are coroner counties where there's an elected official, and some counties are medical examiner counties where they actually have an appointed forensic pathologist who's the medical examiner. Some of the smaller rural counties, in fact, many of them in eastern Washington and along the gorge, the medical or the coroner is actually the prosecuting attorney for that county. They don't have a separate elected coroner. So here in Oregon, in the mid-60s, we went from a coroner state to a statewide medical examiner system. And that was done because of perceived excesses in the coroner system. The law was based on our law, ORS 146, was based on the premise that death is a medical problem. And the best people to examine why somebody dies is a physician, specifically a forensic pathologist who specializes in that. And also, it laid out sort of the structure of the system in that the state was to provide forensic pathology services and the counties were to provide local death investigation services. I, as a state medical examiner, appoint all county medical examiners around the state, and by law they have to report every death that falls under the medical examiner's law to my office, and we review every death by report through that mechanism in the state medical examiner's office.
Can you share with us what are the qualifications to become a county medical examiner?
The qualifications are that you're a physician. You do not have to be a pathologist or a forensic pathologist because we only have six of them here in the state, but you must be a physician. Now, many of these physicians just do this for a community service, and every county has a different way of paying their county medical examiner. In some counties, they actually pay for their health insurance. That's their pay. In some counties, they pay by the case, and others, they pay a retainer. I was just talking with Jefferson County, and I'm not exactly sure they pay anything from my conversation with the DA there. But so it's a mishmash around the state about how they get paid.
Thank you.
So as the state medical examiner's office, we're located in Clackamas County, in Clackamas, Oregon, and we cover the entire state except for Jackson, Josephine, Coos, Curry, Klamath, and Lake counties. Those counties are covered by a contract pathologist who is contracted directly with those counties to provide forensic pathology services. The rest of the state, all of the cases come to us that have to be autopsied. All of the cases, even in those other six counties, are reviewed by my office. We also administer the toxicology services for the whole state. So I had to pick counties that I was instructed to pick systems that were similar to our system, and of course there's no state system here on the West Coast except for the state of Oregon. We, by the way, were the first state west of the Mississippi to adopt the state medical examiner system. So I chose Spokane County, San Francisco County, King County in Washington, Los Angeles County, and then, of course, our county. And you can see by looking at the table some of the numbers. I would point out that while it says our jurisdiction population here is essentially 3.8 million, that's a mistype because, actually, I wasn't including those six counties in southern Oregon. So despite that, the number is correct that in Oregon, there's one forensic pathologist for every 638,000 people, which is considerably more than the other jurisdictions that we examined.
Mr. Chair, she is referring to a table which should be in your packet. I think probably the last page in this portion of the packet that was attached to their letter.
And what I was doing here was looking at how much it costs per cases that are reported to each office, and secondarily, how much it costs for each postmortem exam by each office. And how I did that was I just got the salaries of the forensic pathology services for each county that I looked at, and then I divided it amongst the counties reported, or the cases reported, and the cases performed as far as postmortem exams. As far as the cost per case reported, we are at $203, and that case reported is a case where we have examined either by postmortem exam, by records or case review, or by ordering forensic toxicology services for that. So all those 4,000 cases that are reported to our office, in some way a forensic pathologist has touched that case, reviewed it, looked at it, or done an autopsy or postmortem exam on it. And as far as the number of postmortem exams that our office does, we did, and this is from 2010, our latest numbers that we have, we did 1,110 at a cost of $743 per case. The only other county that had a lesser cost as far as cost per examination is King County, where they had $628 per case. In King County, some of their pathologists, what they count as pathologists, are actually trainees who get paid less than half of what a regular pathologist gets paid. So I think that's where we see the difference, is that there's a difference in pay scale there. And I think you can see some of the other numbers are higher than ours. For instance, San Francisco, they have $1,129 per case examined and per case reported. I am happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Hicks.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hello, Doctor. Good to see you again. Could you explain, please, there are, there six members of your staff, pathologists? Is that right? Six?
Representative Smith and Representative Hicks. We have actually five forensic pathologists.
Okay.
One is in Lane County. Four are in the Clackamas County office. And then in addition to that, we have another set of support staff, three clerical staff, one morgue attendant, and one administrator who helps me.
Okay, thank you. And one follow-up.
Please.
Where, and there's only six in the state, forensic pathologists, where in their career path are these six individuals? Are they nearing retirement, or where are we at there?
Representative Smith, Representative Hicks. Well, one of the members of my office has been in the office since 1971. So he is at the end of his career, and we'll be having to replace him very shortly. I have been there 26 years, and one of my colleagues has been there 15 and the other 10. And then just recently we hired another person for Lane County, which took me 3 years to find this person. And he's my age, but he's just started in with us. So most of us are in, everybody is older than 42, let's put it that way. And so there will be a turnover coming.
May I ask one follow-up? Where are you going to find replacements? Please.
Representative Smith, Representative Hicks, that is a very good question, because in the United States right now, there's about 350 to 400 forensic pathologists who practice like we do. There are a few more who practice in hospital settings and do autopsies for coroners, like in California and so forth. So we probably could use another 1,000 forensic pathologists in the United States right now, but I'm hoping, just because of our tremendous location and wish to live in Oregon, I might be able to attract some people as time goes on.
Thank you. Yeah. I have two questions, Doctor. In the chart you provided us, you talk about the cost per examination. Can you talk a little bit about the time to complete an examination? How do we compare?
Representative Smith, we usually take an autopsy length of time, just doing the actual case, can vary anywhere from 1 hour to 8 hours, depending on what the case is. If we have a complicated child abuse case, that takes several hours to do. A more straightforward natural disease, probably about 1 hour. But that's not to say that that's the only time that's taken, because once we do that case, we have to look at slides, review medical records, and also do toxicology studies, which we have to interpret. We talk to family members, and in many times we end up going to court, which takes us hours of preparation and court time. So it's a difficult, I'm not sure I can actually answer that, because the same is true for all the rest of the jurisdictions that we're looking at. They would have the same trajectory for each case that they do as we do. So I think we're pretty similar. I will say that in a place like Los Angeles, when they go to court, they're handed a file and they walk into the courtroom without any preparation. Mm-hmm. So once you've, and they might do, it, since it's Los Angeles, they might do four homicides in a day, one of them, And then 6 months later, they're ending up going to court, but they have no time to prepare for it. So it's a that's a whole different ball of wax.
Let me ask one more question, and I qualify this question with the statement that I have no clue what I'm talking about. So let me qualify that. How do you measure the accuracy of your analysis, of your staff's analysis?
We have a program where we rotate files. So once you've completed a case, then we might send 10% or a little bit less to another pathologist to look at. It's an internal quality control. The other issues that come up, the other things that we do, is that actually in the United States we have standards for autopsy performance in the forensic pathology field. And so we have those standards. We follow those standards as laid out by the National Association of Medical Examiners. So I think that while we don't have like an institutional review board or anything like that, we have tried to do an internal review on cases. And those cases are just selected by the medical transcriptionists and handed off to you, you know, so it's not like we've picked them.
Got it. Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator, please.
You mentioned the counties that actually use pathologists, but they use them on a contract basis. And Coos was one, and I represent part of that county, so I'm curious about that. Why do they do that? Is it supply and demand? They just don't have that many calls for using the pathologist?
Representative Smith, Senator Verger, yes, in Coos County that's the case. However, since I became the medical examiner in 1999, I've tried to regionalize the medical examiner system, and part of that request, the policy option package that I have made every legislative session, is to have money to pay for the forensic pathologist in Southern Oregon. I recognize that it's not fair that they have to pay while the rest of the state doesn't, and it's sort of a quirk, if you will, of history that it worked out that way. And we don't have any money to pay him, and so that's how it worked out that way. But every legislative session I've asked for funds to pay for him, as well as for funds to pay for a Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon forensic pathologist so that people don't have to travel as far.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up. Well, we have had more murder cases in the last year than we have ever had. And one of the cases that we had after they closed the lab there, we actually had to leave the person out on the beach and had to keep somebody with him all night, covered in a blanket, because we didn't have any way. This isn't a good way to do business, and so I'm just trying to keep my eye on how we can do better because our counties are struggling with expenses now.
May I respond?
Please.
Representative Smith, Senator Verger, I agree with you completely, and the goal of my office has been to provide consistent death investigation, whether you're in Coos County or Multnomah County. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to do that through our education system, but since we only have this small number of people, we have to spread our resources, and I understand completely what you're saying, because part of the problem there is waste of resources by having somebody stand there and have to watch this person, mm-hmm. and the other problem is loss of evidence from that body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Senator Monroe.
Somebody's killed in Ontario. Do you send somebody there to do the investigation, or do you bring the body to you?
Representative Smith, Senator Monroe, we bring the body to us because we have the modern facility out in Ontario. We would have to do that in a funeral home, and that's not acceptable in today's forensic environment and how we have to do things in court. In fact, we are bringing somebody from Boise who died in Boise, but was from the Snake River Correction Facility. Oh, yeah. We'll be doing that case tomorrow. That.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Yes, sir. I mean, though in Josephine County, they do it in the funeral home.
I know
that. It is not a sophisticated as I think they may appear on TV.
I'm sorry, you're exactly
in certain
right.
cases, yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Any other questions, any other comments?
I'd just briefly comment, of course, known the good doctor, and their office just does great work, and it's how they can determine the death is very educational to me, and I learned more in the, I think I've attended 14 autopsies. I certainly learned more than I ever did in a biology class. Great instructors. Thank you for your good work.
Thank you, sir.
All righty. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledgement of the receipt of the report. And I'll also add that what makes some of these comparisons difficult is, for example, the statewide medical examiner also is the county medical examiner for the three metro counties, so there's added responsibility in that function, too. They act both as a statewide for the entire state, but they also, for the three largest counties in the state, act as the county medical examiner, too. So comparisons are never easy in this area.
Well, it looks like you've given this a thumbs up.
Yes.
So we have a request before us.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
I move acknowledging receipt of the report from the Office of State Medical Examiner, or from the Oregon State Police.
Co-Chair Nolan moves that we accept a report on the cost of the Oregon State Police Office of the State Medical Examiner. Any discussion?
Carrier.
We need a carrier.
A good doctor should come and carry it.
Yeah. Well, I would, but I'm not on full.
Yeah,
you're not
you
on full.
I think that's a great idea, then.
You're not full. Senator Monroe, would you carry this?
Sure.
Thank you. All righty. Let's open up. Let me get my agenda here. Let's open up the work session.
Thank you, Doug.
Let's open up the work session on the Oregon Military Department report on 911 consolidation. Welcome.
Back again.
Why don't we start with John, if you'd give us an
sure.
update.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. Before you is the military department with the 911 consolidation study. This study was originally requested during the 2009 legislative session, and after several what could be called maybe false starts, this is a the report is being submitted before you. The original budget note asked the military department to conduct a study of the relative merits of public safety answering point consolidation throughout the state with the intent of reducing redundancy and creating a more cost-efficient delivery system. The department is worked with a nationally recognized consultant, L.R. Kimball, who is here to conduct the study. The firm categorizes its analysis as an overview rather than an a detailed examination or a plan for consolidation efforts. The firm notes that they've undertaken similar studies in other states and that there is a growing nationwide trend toward consolidation of PSAPs, and that the cost of next generation 911 technology is seen as one of the primary drivers for consolidation. So with that, co-chair,
thank you.
The department is here.
Welcome.
Glad to be here, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Military Department and the Interim Director of the Office of Emergency Management. With me today is Joel McComley from L.R. Kimball, and he'll be making the presentation. First off, I'll reiterate what Mr. Borden indicated. We were given the legislative fiscal note to do what he stated. I won't repeat it. To accomplish this, we formed a consolidation task force initially. The task force is made of multiple stakeholders who spent numerous hours to develop and modify and provide a consolidated task force report. The report was provided in December of 2010 to this board, or the emergency board, and I think, as previously indicated, that report did not meet the requirements outlined with the original budget note. The military department was then asked to report back to the 2011 legislative session with a report that did meet these requirements. We had engaged LR Mark Kimball, an outside vendor and subject matter expert in the 911 and public safety arena. The report, known as the Kimball Phase 1 Report, was presented to the 2011 legislature. Phase 1 Report took into account other means which were available to bring about technological consolidation based on a new and developing technologies, as we call next generation or next gen. In 2011, the 2011 legislature again believed that it did not meet the requirements that you had set out. So we amended the initial contract with L.R. Kimball and provided the report that you're going to get today. On February 1 of this year, L.R. Kimball completed his consolidation report to answer the budget note authored in this, by this committee, and they are here today and they're going to present it. For this report, L.R. Kimball was asked not only to provide a consolidation report based on the current structure of 911 in the state of Oregon, but also to take into account and provide information to answer other questions that have arisen over the past few years and months as to the consolidation possibilities. We believe this report, once presented, does meet the intent of the committee as the completed response to the budget note. With that said, I'll turn the microphone over to Joel and let him lead you through the report.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name, for the record, is Joel McCamley. I'm from the great state of Pennsylvania, and I'm happy to be here in the great state of Oregon today to speak with you on this matter. As General Caldwell mentioned, we have provided a pretty extensive report with much detail. I believe all of you have a copy of that or have been presented with a copy of that. My intent today is not to go through that report in great detail with you, but more to provide an overview, provide some commentary with respect to the findings. We are certainly prepared to get into detail if you're so inclined to do so. I do have some colleagues with me today that would help answer any questions that you might have that I might not be able to answer. And I'll just walk you through some of our findings, some of the things that we've encountered as we've gone through this process, and hopefully it will satisfy, as the general mentioned, the budget note. I'm going to start just by giving you an overview of the scope of our project and what we were asked to do. It's been stated a couple times, but this committee and the legislature did draft a budget note. The consolidation report, the presentation to the legislature is hopefully we're going to satisfy that today. We looked at three things in this report. We looked at the current environment in the state of Oregon. We looked at some pretty specific scenarios with respect to 911 and how 911 calls might be answered. We looked at one call center model as well as a potential number of smaller or reduced number of 911 call centers. And I'll be prepared to talk about all of those. I'm going to actually take you through five scenarios, which we'll get into in a moment. A little bit on how we developed our information and really what formed the basis of the data that you have in the report. As the general mentioned, and I believe as John mentioned, we do this sort of work in many places, and one of the first orders of business was to determine the current operating environment in the state of Oregon. So we sent out a survey to all the 911 centers, collected a lot of information, asked them a lot of information with respect to systems, technology, operations, facts and figures, number of calls answered, those sorts of things. We sent it to all 49 911 centers in the state. We received complete information from 32 of those, almost complete information from another 15. So we're working with a pretty good data set out of 47 of the 49 911 centers. We also conducted some on-site visits. We visited with 911 centers across the spectrum, again, to understand how some of the technology has been implemented, what kind of systems they have in place, what their operations look like, just to get a good understanding of how calls work in Oregon. Not that they're too different from any place else, but again, just to understand some of the local lay of the land. And then we were also fortunate enough to be able to be part of a couple of industry conferences here in Oregon, where the PSAP community had come together for various training and education, et cetera, and we were able to conduct some focus and study groups at those locations as well, and we're able to get input from the various stakeholder communities at those events. The general mentioned Next Generation 911. You'll see this referred to throughout the report as Next Gen and G911. It simply means this. Today's 911 system is by and large operated in an analog fashion. It is still largely based off of the telephony system that I grew up with. I'm sure most of you did with a phone in your house. Today's environment where many of us, I'm sure everybody in this room has a cell phone, today's 911 system doesn't handle that kind of technology very well, nor is it set up to handle future technologies that might come about as a result of advances in communications technology, et cetera. So the next gen part is really shifting that whole infrastructure to a digital technology that will accommodate many different types of data and information, much more so than is possible today through a traditional landline phone with a call to 911. So that in essence is what Next Generation 911 is. We looked at a number of different scenarios and that I will walk you all through with respect to cost, how do those costs change if you do transition to new technologies, how do they stay the same or maybe increase if you stay on a legacy type system, and I'll detail some of those as we go through the various efforts, but it is explained in great detail in the report that you have. Mentioned that we're going to talk about five different scenarios. I would focus you on the first three. Primarily, we'll talk through most of those and spend most of our time talking about those. The final two, we will walk through each of those as you deem necessary, although they do pretty much keep business the way it is with respect to technology. And we're not certain that that's a good place to be, given that the rest of the country is moving towards adopting these new technologies. And I think you'll see that some of the information that we've compiled and have applied, it actually costs more to stay where we're at than it does to move to a different platform. But we'll talk through all those things. Some assumptions that are driving the cost analyses that you'll see in the report and that we'll detail here in a couple of slides. You're going to see some different costs in years one and two, and then you'll see some operating costs and some fixed costs that will perpetuate throughout the following years of the study. Those costs that are incurred in year one and two are, we made some assumptions. One, that you're going to move to some new technology, and with that you're going to have some capital costs and expenditures to get you there. So it means things like replacing the current network with an IP-enabled network. There's some cost differences that come about as a result of that. Remove interconnections for wireless carriers or cellular carriers that connect into the 911 system today. Remove selective routing charges for wireless calls, because again, we're going to be a system like this would bring those calls in a different way and ultimately reduce costs. That's what others are seeing around the country. And it also assumes that we're not replacing equipment unless it's necessary, and any new equipment replacements would be compliant with the new technologies and be able to work with in a next generation 911 environment. A couple of other points, especially in year two, the assumptions there that we made and that you'll see reflected in the costs are that equipment replacements will begin. Wireline transition, or the existing telephony network, would be transitioned into this next generation 911 environment. Various databases that support 911 calls would be transitioned as well. We mentioned a specific protocol here, but again, it's just more technology to help locate individuals who are calling for aid, depending upon where they are. And that's done a little bit differently in the next generation 911 systems than they are today. So with that, I'll go ahead and start into the various scenarios that we've laid out in the report. Scenario one is essentially not much has changed, except we're going to change all the plumbing. I'll make it as simple as that. All 49 911 centers in the state remain where they're at, but you will see that as we walk through the cost analyses, the costs change and they shift. And we're actually projecting that we would anticipate that the agency would realize a cost savings, the program itself would realize a potential cost savings going forward after the transition occurs. A couple of things I need to point out with this scenario. One is the assumption that we are, that the agency is going to move for the things that are paid for by the agency, they're going to move into an unregulated environment, meaning that the charges that are currently carried by the program are done so in a regulated environment. They're tariffed. They're tariffed by the telephone companies and the regulatory commission here in the state of Oregon. So there's a set charge for connectivity. There's a set charge for distance for certain circuits that facilitate 911 calls, et cetera. When you move into the new environment, that tends to be in a different environment. It's unregulated, and you tend to get best of price. There's a lot more competition for those kinds of services, and the technology actually allows some of the to break down some of the barriers that exist in the regulated environment, in particular what are called LATA boundaries, or in the old days whenever you picked up a phone to call somebody in another area code, you incurred long-distance charges. Those boundaries still exist today, and believe it or not, we still have to pay to cross those sometimes or somewhat arbitrary lines. So it does add cost to the various scenarios, especially if you stay on the legacy side. So, as I mentioned, it assumes all 49 PSAPs that are in existence today, as well as the workstations that they have, will be transitioned and replaced to a new delivery network and some new capabilities. With that comes a lot of new potential service levels on the other side. But by and large, it just assumes that everything kind of stays the same. We're just changing out the plumbing. And I'll walk you through the cost analyses here. Couple things to note here, and you'll see four more of these. I'm not trying to bore you with the numbers, but there are some commonalities across the various scenarios. On the left-hand side, you will see the incoming revenues to the program. Our assumption is that those are not going to increase. As a matter of fact, you will probably see, I believe we have some materials that back this up, that revenues are actually declining into the program. For various reasons, but that we don't need to cover here. But our assumption is the revenues are going to stay fairly static. We've seen the bubble of everybody buying a cellular telephone and those sorts of things occur. So we're not going to see continued growth of revenues outside of natural population growth. The legacy costs that you see in the second column, there will continue to be some legacy costs in all of these scenarios, just simply because anytime we're going to connect the existing telephony network, landline network that most of us have in our homes, we still have to incur some charges there as a result if we want to include them in the 911 system. And there would be no reason why you wouldn't include them in that system, but there are going to be some costs carried forward as we go. The scenario one, available funding and total costs for the year, those breakdowns, again, you'll see differences as we talk through the various scenarios here. But in this one in particular, you'll note that after this transition costs are incurred, and one other thing I need to point out to you is that as the transition occurs, you're actually going to be paying for both systems for a period of time. So you're going to have to pay for implementing the new while keeping the old up and running. We obviously don't want to have any sort of drop in service or any sort of service interruption. So there will be a period of time where those costs get carried in tandem for a while. And again, we're assuming that carries through the first 2 years. So as a result, in transitioning in this direction without reducing any 911 centers or the number of positions in those 911 centers, our estimates show that the program would probably start to realize an operating surplus of about $5.7 million a year under this scenario. And that's almost 100% borne out by the fact that we're going from a regulated environment to an unregulated environment. So those costs are carried today by the system. Going into a new system, even despite it being new technology and changing out a new implementation, it's really shows you the difference between the technologies and how they're purchased and how they're regulated or not regulated in this case. So that is scenario one.
Really quick, can you help me understand what it means to be regulated and not regulated?
Chairman Smith, absolutely. I believe, remember AT&T back in the days before the divestiture was the big regulated phone company. Regulated simply means that a governmental agency regulated
the
operations
the
of that.
So, I get the context. Gotcha. I wasn't understanding the context. Thank you.
There are mandated fees and tariffs that 911 centers have to pay for the services provided by the phone company.
I understand the context.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I might add that this chart number 13 million. We're really talking about the 35% account that we buy the equipment and run the backbone on. It's not the entire enchilada, and we can talk about that later. And there's an excellent pie chart on page 49 that you can look at, and it kind of gives you an idea of how that money is generated to get that 13 million.
Thank you, General. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, please, John.
It may be good for the issue to be framed about how this relates to consolidation. And what page we're on in the report, please?
Sure. Hang on one second.
If you can't find it easily, that's fine. But
while he's looking, Mr. Chairman, could I ask General Caldwell a couple of questions? General Caldwell, how did you settle on the Kimball company? Were there bids or?
Co-Chair and Senator Berger, we settled on Kimball. One, we used the state procurement system to do this. We went directly to them, however, and did not do a competitive bid based on time. One. Two, they also did Washington's report, very similar question from their legislature, and they did one in New Hampshire, was it, or Vermont?
We've done it for California as well.
California and Washington. Mm-hmm. So they did both of those. We were very confident based on the results after talking to both those folks that run theirs that this was the right kind of company to work this with.
So it was mainly by referral?
Yes, ma'am.
And what was the cost of the study?
I'm going to have to look at my bean counter back here, Sean. It was right at $500,000.
500?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you find it? Yes.
One other question, Mr. Chairman. And how long have they worked on the study?
I think we, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Berger, this report actually started in, I think I said it in my earlier statement of 2010. And that was phase one, which was basically about next generation. Phase two, we began it in 2011. It was 2011. The summer of 2011, we asked them to shift gears from the first portion of the report, which was considerably less than the $500,000, and we added this piece onto that in order to meet the deadline for the February session.
So the $500,000 was the total?
Yes, ma'am.
There was no charge in 2010 or 2011?
I don't know how we paid it out. I think we paid it out as they did their report. I don't know that we paid them up front.
But still total $500,000?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Why don't we continue?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The cost analyses of the scenarios that we're speaking about begin on page 58 of the report, and the various diagrams that and tables and charts that we're showing on the screen are detailed in more detail on those pages there. I just walked through scenario one, which I believe is shown on page, the beginnings of it are shown on page 58, and I'm going to talk about scenario two as well. Or begin speaking about scenario two, I should say. Scenario two assumes one statewide call center. At this point, I'd just like to draw a distinction for you with respect to answering a 911 call and then actually dispatching the services required for that 911 call. Today in Oregon, those two things happen coincident. In other words, if a 911 call is made, it goes to a 911 center. That agency fields that call, determines what the emergency is, then determines what agencies to dispatch, and then operates the radio system and dispatches fire, police, or EMS as appropriate to respond to whatever the incident might be. Once you start talking about consolidation, once we start talking about all these various scenarios, there will be times when you talk about separating those two events. There are models that exist all across the country where you have them coincident and co-located. There are models where you don't. In the scenario two, where you have one call center for the entire state, our assumption is that you then have to, by default, to separate those two activities. In other words, answering the call is one part of the process, dispatching it is another. So there would still need to be a requirement with this scenario in particular for a dispatch function at the, you know, essentially today that you have in the 49 911 centers throughout the state. So we'll talk through some of that.
I have a question here. Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And though it is still separated, I know at least in Josephine County, we have the 911 center, and then they will refer it out to the responding agency. So it's not entirely monolithic, at least that's my impression at the moment.
Chairman Smith, Representative Hicks, the function, though, that it actually occurs, in other words, the call comes in, is answered by a person in the call center. That person then, in most cases in Oregon, then can turn right to a console at their position and dispatch that fire or police or emergency medical services agency. Mm-hmm. So it's the same person handles the incident from beginning to end. In some of the scenarios, especially in scenario two that we're speaking about, that would not be the case.
Yeah. I mean, I know because I listen to 911 calls. I've listened to a lot of them. In Josephine County, that's so you have the person calls 911, reports in a panic what's going on, and then frankly they have to go over it all again because they get referred to the sheriff's department, say, and the sheriff says, hello, sheriff's dispatch, what's going on, and it's the whole story all over again. And so I just want to highlight that. I didn't even realize, I must admit, that wasn't going on elsewhere in the state, but it sounds like that's an anomaly versus a norm.
Chairman Smith, Representative Hicks, it isn't necessarily an anomaly or a norm. You will see that model prevalent both ways or not throughout the country. It really comes down to an operational model that a 911 center will adopt. As you start talking about, or as we start talking through consolidation and what that means and how it's done, you then have to start talking about those things typically as separate. In other words, the person who's answering the call is not necessarily the one that's going to be dispatching it. So you do begin to introduce scenarios as you have suggested, meaning that a person gets transferred from one place to another. Information needs to be perhaps given again. I will tell you that one of the foundational elements of Next Generation 911 is that information transfer and or the potential of missing or losing information should be more seamless because those systems begin to interoperate better and interface better. Plus, you have a lot more data that can be passed along with that call and with that information than we're capable of doing in today's 911 system.
Please thank you. I remember from last session Representative Barker's story about how he was calling in a DUI and he had to cross the county line a couple of times, and every time he did, he had to explain to a new operator what was going on. And so in this scenario, would this scenario solve that problem, worsen the problem, or be neutral on that kind of problem?
Chairman Smith, Representative Hicks, with respect to scenario two, the one call center or one statewide call center, that would worsen that problem.
It would worsen it. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Some of the other scenarios we have, it would potentially be better or be improved based on just applying the technology that we're speaking of.
If I might just real Please. Quick, what happened was I was on I-5, they put me to the state police dispatcher, the person takes an exit and they put me to the Washington County dispatcher. Then the guy turns to go over an overpass, they put me to Clackamas County dispatcher, and I finally went home or went on down the freeway. But unfortunate that, you know, somebody didn't take the call and was able just to transfer the information back and forth. Great. Thank you.
So here's where we are. We have 35 minutes. So I want to make sure you have ample time to go through your entire report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do. I assure you the first three scenarios are really the ones of focus
and
that we're going to be speaking about. So back to scenario two, next generation one statewide call center that would assume a single in-state call center that would field all 911 calls. And it would consolidate a number of things with respect to cost, because you're now, rather than having 49 different connections, you're talking about one, in essence. Now, obviously, you'd have to have some redundancy and duplicity in the system in case certain events might occur that would take it out or take it down. But in general, you know, we're talking about a much reduced footprint with respect to answering the calls. The dispatching side of it would not change in our estimation. We'd still need to have the requirement to call out all of the agencies within the jurisdiction that the call is happening in. Call takers will process the calls to determine the location of the incident, the nature, and then transfer, as we've discussed, that call to another agency to handle the disposition of it. That breaks the chain of accountability. In some instances, it does require things like having to relay the information again and or repeat the vital information and statistics that are provided the first time. It isn't unusual for calls to be transferred when necessary, but this system would require a call transfer with every call, as opposed to ones that might be done because of a technology glitch or a misroute or the example that Representative Barker gave us before. That doesn't happen all the time, but in this scenario, that would. As I also mentioned, it assumes that all 49 current PSAPs would continue to dispatch for their existing jurisdictions. The cost table again, we're starting to begin to talk about things on page 59. The cost table that we're talking about, the left-hand column remains the same. The legacy costs in the middle are roughly the same as in scenario one. Scenario two costs begin to change in the middle column that has, as well as the available funding stays the same, and the total costs for the year begin to drive down based on the fact that we're moving from paying for 49 systems to one, in essence. It does drive a cost savings out the other side once the transition of new technology occurs. That's represented a little higher than the cost savings that are projected to the agency in scenario one.
Co-chair, if I may.
Please.
The figures you're looking at, again, to emphasize what General Caldwell said, these are from the 35% sub-account. So the assumption here is that the bulk of the funds continue to flow to the local PSAP community. Again, this is, you know, on an annual basis, it looks like it's, you know, a $12 to $13 million program. But on a biennial basis, we're talking about an $80 million program. So just this piece is what the analysis is based on that Kimball is working from, is the sub-account dollars.
That's good enough.
All right. Scenario three. Scenario three is probably the major focus of our report and our findings. It does take into consideration data that we gathered and analyzed about 911 operations within the state of Oregon. It does assume a reduction in the number of 911 centers as well as the number of call answering positions that are available to answer 911 calls. It would provide, in our opinion, a balance perhaps between current operations and future operations while leveraging new technologies and the cost efficiencies that those new technologies bring to bear. We make no specific recommendation of where a 911 center would be within this model. It has more to do with, based on the call volumes, the populations, the geography of the state of Oregon, again, largely based in the current environment as we saw it and as we saw the statistics and figures come in. It was through our best analysis that this model could be used and applied going forward if consolidation is a driver here.
So when you were doing your survey, did you provide scenario 3 as a question for them to look at?
Chairman Smith, we did not necessarily provide scenario 3 in the survey. The survey was actually used to help develop scenario 3. The agency's been very open with the PSAP community with respect to this study and what it was we were trying to do and the desired outcomes that were to come about as a result of it. That was a long answer, but no,
okay,
Chairman, we did
you.
Not. As I mentioned, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about scenario 3. I want to give you just a flavor of some of the reasons somebody would consider consolidation. And as has been mentioned before, this is a national trend. Given the economic times that we're in, many, many locations, many state agencies are taking a look at this, trying to understand if it's possible to consolidate services and maintain the same level of service while driving cost efficiencies. So all of those things come into play, and those are all perhaps a validation of what it is that you're trying to look at. Lots of other folks are doing that as well, many states included, state of Maine, state of Connecticut, state of North Carolina. A number have tried various approaches to this, but again, you're not alone in taking a look at this. Some of the benefits that consolidated agencies see as a result of actually going through and implementing a consolidation. You have an alignment of local jurisdictions with federal interoperability initiatives. There's been a lot of Department of Homeland Security spending in this area over the years, starting to tail off these days, but regionalization, being able to communicate with each other regardless of where we're from and what our agencies are, has really been the mantra of the last 10 years, and especially since September the 11th. So consolidation really helps enable and facilitate that sort of interaction. It helps break down the silos that have evolved into and from. Improved use of funding dollars by implementing a shared services model. That is what most municipalities look at first and assume that is what will come out the other side. Our findings through experience are that it doesn't always necessarily cost less. You ultimately drive efficiencies into the cost. You don't necessarily save costs. They move around, they shift, then those sorts of things. And I can get into some of that detail as well. You begin to see improved service levels, improved standardization of care, standard of service begin to be implemented, again, just simply because that becomes the focus as opposed to a jurisdictional focus. We've seen some improvements we have victim survivability here, but really the speed with which a call can be handled and dealt with in the disposition of the emergency dispatched as well. Again, it can become because of consolidated training or standardized training, standardized operations, those sorts of things. Improved emergency response during large-scale incidents and natural disasters. Oregon has some unique geography and has some unique potential natural disasters, and there are legitimate reasons why looking at a regional as opposed to a jurisdictional one would provide benefit. And this is one, again, that a lot of people latch on to, but there is a potential for long-term local cost efficiency. That is ultimately where we see cost savings occur, is at the local level, because every town, every municipality is no longer trying to fund its own 911 center and its own 911 operation. So you do see cost efficiency get borne out there. Some other consolidation benefits. Sharing of information among user agencies is improved, again, because you have same platform, similar technologies. The protocols are the same, tend to be the same. You can share information much, much easier. Police, fire, and EMS receive the same level of service. You begin to build a career ladder for 911 staff, consistent in-service training for PSAP staff, some of the things I've mentioned already. One other thing, in some cases, efficiencies that are gained through consolidation are not going to be instantaneous. Again, I mentioned that we rarely ever see an immediate cost savings borne out by a consolidation effort. You might ask yourself why. In part of our analysis, we've done a study as to how many call answering positions there are in the 911 centers in the state of Oregon. Your predominant model is a two-position 911 center, meaning that there are two answering positions in that 911 center. You have to staff at least 50% of that to be operational. If you take four of those and say, all right, we're going to consolidate, you now need potentially an eight-position 911 center, none of which was in the mix originally. So you might have to build a new building, you might have to find a new facility, you might have to consolidate systems, et cetera. So the capital cost of doing some of those things at the local level begin to look prohibitive and or eat up the initial cost savings that you might assume would be in this scenario. We wanted to share with you some feedback that we did get from the PSAP community as we conducted our surveys, as we had our focus group meetings and our site visits. And these are consistent with other concerns that we've seen raised and addressed throughout the country. Degraded level of service, you take the local out of local response. I'm not making a judgment as to whether or not that's correct or not. The response always has to be local. You're never going to get away from a local response to a 911 call from a person in Salem. You're not going to send a fire department from Portland to Salem to handle a house fire. So the response is always going to be local. Loss of ancillary duties, what does that mean? As with anything else, Oregon is no different than any other place in the country with respect to what do people do when they're not answering 911 calls. They tend to be doing other things, answering administrative calls, doing warrants, doing licensing, doing all sorts of things that you would never imagine. If you're really just taking a pure look at answering 911 calls and dispatching them, all of those, and you're talking about doing that in a different place, all those other functions that those people perform need to be done somewhere or by somebody else. Today it's being done in many cases within the confines of the 911 center. Delays in dispatch time. Again, you may have the scenario, if you think back to scenario number two, where we have one call center, dispatching is done still at the local level and or at remote sites. You may, the system itself may bring about some delays just simply because you're transferring from one place to another and you're moving that call down the line. Loss of local control and local resources, loss of previous investments in radio system and other large ticket technology items. Concerns of possible...
Really quick before you move on, can you go back and talk about how communities have dealt with that loss of previous investment? That seems to be an issue I hear in rural eastern Oregon. They've made the investment. Now what do they do with this equipment?
Chairman Smith, absolutely. This is my business, what I do for a living. One of the worst things anybody can do in our situation is recommend that you strand or have to forklift an investment of public dollars, especially for something as pricey or potentially pricey as a radio system. The fact of the matter is there's been a lot of technology gains over the last few years where, and especially as we talk about moving into a next generation 911 environment, any system you're going to buy today is generally compliant with and is capable of operating in either a legacy environment or a next generation 911 environment. So you're not going to strand an investment in that necessarily. On the radio side, which is not the purview of the agency, that can be a little bit of a of a stickier wicket. Now, with respect to whether or not somebody's 800 megahertz radio system is interoperable with somebody else's 450, there are devices and technologies out there that can make those things work together. We don't try to address that in this report specifically, although you will note that in this scenario that we are talking about, we do say that that would need to be looked at in this regional model that
we're
talking about.
And if we were considering this recommendation, and I think there's logic in what you're sharing, but in that scenario, there would be additional cost to address that type of issue.
That is, Chairman Smith, yes, there would be.
Okay, let's continue.
Thank you, sir. Concerns of possible unfunded mandate from the state, difficult and costly to establish, loss of dispatcher positions. Again, all of those are concerns that were shared with us and are pretty commonplace when you start talking about consolidation. To continue on, loss of local geographic knowledge, difficulty implementing improvements or making needed changes. Meshing different cultures takes time. That is absolutely true. Community outreach would suffer loss of personal connection to the community. Again, all of these things we encounter almost on a daily basis as we help municipalities walk through, plan, or implement these sorts of things. This is not an easy thing to do. I can tell you that right now. These are some of the most difficult and charged projects that we work on, just simply because of the number of people it impacts and the number of stakeholders that are involved in this scenario that we lump into as public safety and or 911 and response.
I just want to take one more moment here, and I want to talk about the loss of local geographic knowledge, and I want to go back to Rep. Barker's conversation. A few years back in Morrow County, I came upon an auto accident, called 911, and the dispatcher had no clue, absolutely no clue where I was. As a matter of fact, it was a 911 operator from the state of Washington who I was calling with my cell phone. I called 911 on my cell phone. It went to the state of Washington. Now, I want to share another thought with you really quick, and then I want to make a point here. I think your presentation has been very professional, very good. There's an observation, though, that goes to this loss of local geographic knowledge. Morrow County has been cut out of Umatilla County. Okay. Now, anyone from Eastern Oregon would know that Morrow and Umatilla County are like this. Okay. Now, that's no comment on your report. I think it's been very well done. The concern I struggle with in consolidation is how do you manage that geographical knowledge, knowing that it is so diverse around the state? And even with 9 regional centers, how have you seen other states manage that diversity?
Chairman Smith, that's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked that, actually. To address the diagram, which we'll throw up here on the screen, that was our best estimate of what might naturally occur regionally.
You bet. And I don't want to critique that, but it fed into my loss of geographic knowledge.
Understood. The environment that we're talking about transitioning to, and in some cases, regardless of consolidation or in spite of, is next generation 911. The very scenario that you painted, very common scenario. You mentioned it was a few years ago. The technologies have improved to the point where they should be able to locate you now. Now, you also added in another layer of complexity in that you're in one state and a cell tower in another picked it up and you got routed where it got routed. We're actually talking about, and that actually highlights one of the downfalls of the current system that we operate in, because we weren't able to take intelligence, put it into the network, and say, oh, well, he's in Oregon calling, and I just happen to be a tower in Washington, and I'm picking it up. Next Generation 911, how does it begin to address the geographic and local knowledge of geography and street names and common places is through the use of technology, through the use of geographic information systems. Now, it requires a certain base or level of geographic information systems data, but our operating experience is that most municipalities have some layer of it now. There are numerous commercial ventures out there. Google Maps is a perfect example that I can bring to mind for you right now, that begin to say that we are transitioning and moving into a world where there are devices that know where you are. As a matter of fact, your device tends to know where you are. We just have to have better systems to interpret that information that then begins to mitigate. I don't live in Salem, but I'm trying to dispatch a fire on Main Street. But the technology of where that call came from, how it got to my center, and how I'm answering it and dispatching it is really underpinned by the technology and the data that is available to do it. So it's largely by improving the geographic information systems data that's out there. And then the 911 or the next generation technologies that come into play, we're really pushing a lot more intelligence into how does that get there.
Let's do this. I apologize. I've
no
been
problems.
The one interrupting you. We have 15 minutes, and I want to make sure you have all the necessary time.
I believe I do, sir. I only have a couple more slides.
Okay.
Right. I'm going to go back one slide prior to the map and just tell you what our recommendation is based on. What did we look at? What were all the kinds of things that we looked at? We looked at current service levels. We looked at current workloads. We looked at current call volumes. We looked at population dispersion throughout the state. We looked at the geography. We looked at existing radio coverage as was reported to us. We looked at service availability and access, and we looked at political jurisdictions with respect to coming up with some of the lines on the map, if you will. So those were the things that underpinned our analysis. I believe I talked about this already, or some of this already, but some of the key points that we believe need to be considered here. Keeping 911 call taking and dispatch of field personnel together within each regional PSAP best serves the citizens for some of the very things we've talked about. It does not break the chain. It helps maintain consistency of the information and call and data, realizing that some of the technology we've talked about may help mitigate that sort of scenario, but the best scenario is to have call taking and dispatching together. That has been our experience. That has been the best model that we've seen work throughout the country. That brings with it a whole other list of things that need to be dealt with if this is the direction that is taken. To wit, further analysis is needed at the local level prior to proceeding to understand who may consolidate with whom, what kind of systems there are in place in the various 911 centers, because all the underlying infrastructure systems that help a police officer respond or a fireman respond or what have you are all manufactured by different people or developed by different people. So again, you would need to be consolidating some of those things and understanding what those are. Many areas in Oregon already have consolidated. There are models that exist in the community today that are very successful, and we're not trying to say that they aren't or that they shouldn't be looked at. That's actually our recommendation, is you should look at those and see what they did right to make them successful, because obviously it's working. It does not always result in cost savings. I've mentioned that a few times here, and it can result in it almost always results, though, in cost efficiencies, which is a semantic, but that is really what we see. The Scenario 3 cost analysis, again, this is the third one we've walked through, but the left-hand column stays the same. The legacy cost changes a little bit. We still have a connectivity back to the landline telephone system, so that remains the same. The Scenario 3 costs are reflective of what I've just talked about, 9 regional centers, a reduction of the number of workstations that answer those 911 calls. The outlay is the same, and the cost per year. And in this scenario, we project a cost savings to the agency of the 35%. of around, and I can't read it here, it's so small, but it's $9.9 million, I believe. 9.3, sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, again, that would be realized largely by a reduction of costs that the agency currently carries and the adoption of new technologies that ultimately reduce the operating costs in out years. Scenario 4 and 5, I'll lump those together in the name of time. Very similar analyses, but we're not assuming any transition to new technologies, which is why the carrying cost of these two scenarios remains relatively high. We're still operating in a world where we have many connections. Every one of those connections is paid for, and it's still in the regulated environment, which means that the cost of those connections are stipulated, and the agencies have to pay them to the carrier that serves their 911 center. Scenario 4 assumes a statewide call center, very similar to Scenario 2, and Scenario 5 assumes the regional consolidation but retains the legacy infrastructure to adjudicate those calls. Any questions on those two scenarios?
We have one here, Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On the subject of infrastructure, good point to leave off. The implications for Owen, or vice versa here. If we did consolidate, how does that connect with the Owen model?
Mr. Chairman and Co-Vice Chairman Hicks, essentially it doesn't. It's gone from the initial, as you know, from the statewide radio network backbone, which is radio, to the state radio project, and it's been sized down, shrunk down, and so this really doesn't have a connection to that. All of this information really goes over the telecom system. Now, Owen, or state radio project, may indeed come to that conclusion and use those same vendors, those private carriers, to do some of their work as this does, so that's a possibility. But it's really not connected financially and or otherwise.
Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, in terms of the redundancy built into this, the natural disaster, let's say, you know, a volcano explodes, lots of 911 calls, lots of emergencies. For some reason, the private phone line is not working. Where does that leave 911, especially in a consolidated model, without the Owen, the radio piece of it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hicks, if you lose that connectivity, which we've seen happen on the coast a couple times, just in the, 2007 we had the flood and everything was severed. There were some backups that ended up going up through Washington. We actually were able to, at the local level, they were able to establish even some ham radio transmission and also for 911 calls and also through satellites. So they can do that from the local center when you lose that landline. Which would probably be the same scenario you'd do right now. The problem's going to be is that you don't have the towers in a volcano and the people can't get their cell phone and call it, they're not going to get out. And if the landlines are severed, then they're basically, you get 10 can and do 10 cans and a string's going to work because there's really no connectivity. I mean, just a reality.
Yeah.
And a satellite phone is, that's why we have gone and we've invested in the National Guard to our major headquarters to get enough satellite phones that we can get connectivity. We have some systems that the federal government has purchased us that we can set up essentially our own phone company remotely and go to a satellite, come back down to a good switch, and then work it that way. So we have those in place that are usable right now for the state. Local level, families sitting out there in K Street, it's going to be a problem. Go ahead.
Thank you, General. Chairman Smith, Representative Hicks, just add a couple of comparatives for your benefit. The promise of Next Generation 911 deals very much so, the network piece anyway, the infrastructure piece, with that redundancy, with the assumption that something bad happens, and a piece of it goes out. Think of the Internet that we all are accustomed to using today. We don't necessarily... We're not so prescriptive in saying we have to go from A to B, but our email still gets there. That is essentially the kind of technology that we're talking about. So in the regional model that we've laid out there, if you will, as a concept, that takes into account some of those very things. You will, as the general mentioned, Hurricane Katrina came in and wiped out all of the telecommunications infrastructure on the Gulf Coast in Louisiana and Mississippi. That didn't stop 911 calls from occurring. But it did kind of isolate it to that area. What could happen, though, is those calls could still be routed to other places where either information could be obtained, potential response could be obtained from outside of the affected area. And that is really another scenario that we're talking about. In today's 911 system, the legacy system, that doesn't happen. If you have an isolation, you have somebody with a backhoe that cuts through the fiber line, you're down. The network designs, though, of next generation would, if it's done properly, would have diversity and redundancy built into it. The state of California, just as a for instance, is looking at potentially using their radio microwave system as the redundant path for 911 calls, assuming the primary goes down. So you can leverage investment. And in many places, in many states that are looking at this, that's what they're looking at doing as well. They're not saying use the radio infrastructure as the primary. There may be instances where you have to do that just simply because of geography. We're not going to cut fiber through the Cascades necessarily or anything like that or through the gorge, although it's probably easy to do through the gorge. But I think you get my point. You can leverage the investment of Owen or the potential investment of Owen to offset or provide redundancy into this sort of system.
Okay.
On the dispatch side, it could also have play there as well.
One more, if I
might. Yep, please.
So, does the consolidation concept have any implications one way or the other for what you've just described? I mean, this is all theoretical at the moment, but would it be better under a consolidation model, worse, or neutral? Or is that too abstract a question to be asking right now? I mean, we don't ideally want the state and the emergency responders to be entirely and completely dependent on the private phone company, you know, keeping the lines up in the event of a catastrophe. That's not ideal. That's not redundancy. We'd like something more. And so keeping that in mind, if we looked at a consolidation model, I mean, maybe with Owen, maybe we could look at something, linking those two up or not. But if we could build some redundancy in there, you know, I guess I'm a little worried about consolidation. If it's all just happening at one point in the state, if they're isolated in a catastrophe, what does the rest of the state do?
Representative Smith, or Chairman Smith, Representative Hicks, great question. I would answer it this way. The technologies we're talking about actually enable the workaround much better than today's system does.
Okay.
That's not saying that today's system is flawed, and actually the phone companies are very good at trying to keep this system in particular up and running. It has more to do with that it's just dated and it's not staying up to date with our current technologies as consumers that we're driving, smartphones, et cetera, 4G networks, those sorts of things. So it has more to do with the technology that we're talking about in this transition removes that as a barrier, if you will, so that it actually enables a lot of those things to occur, because now you're not bound by a rate center or a wire center that a particular phone company owns. You're really leveraging infrastructure that goes across some of those boundaries that were put up years ago, either by regulation or geography, et cetera.
Okay.
Does that answer your question, sir?
Okay, let's get in there. Thank you. Okay.
Senator Berger.
Did you, during the process of your analysis, communicate with the ON, our radio project people?
Chairman Smith, Senator Berger, we did not specifically do that outside of agency knowledge of the program and the system. Not so much to investigate. That wasn't our charge, if you will. It wasn't to see if they would help outlay or offset some of the costs here. Because my company does stuff in this business, I've been watching Owen and trying to understand what's going on, because every other state in the country is doing the same thing, if you will. They're trying to take a look at how to do it, how not to do it, what does the governance look like, and you know. So in that respect, we did not as it relates to consolidation and the scope of our work that we were looking at. That said, as has been mentioned here in our conversation, if it's an asset that has had public investment, it should be looked at and could be easily leveraged as a backbone, as a transport, irrespective of whether it's Owen or not. You still, all that technology is can be used and leveraged the same way, whether it's the radio system or not. I hope that answers the question for you.
Any other questions? We sure appreciate you coming to Oregon. We appreciate your report, and very well done, very professional, and we appreciate that. General, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, as we wrap up here, I think that there's some some obvious due outs that we're going to need to keep moving this ball down the floor. As you can see, that we've been working with moving toward the next generation as rapidly as we possibly can, looking at all the angles and how do we get there and how do we – the real question is going to remain. We're going to do 48 PSAPs because, as you saw on one of the slides, there's consolidation occurring in March. As you recall, in 1985 when the law was passed, there was 274, I think, PSAPs. We're down to 48 now. So we're going that direction. So I think we're going to need some the department needs guidance from the legislature, to put it just plain and simple. And there's also going to be a discussion. There has to be a discussion in 2013 to reauthorize the current 911 statutes. They sunset. I think it's a perfect opportunity for us to deal with all of the aspects of this whole discussion. At the end of the day, there's always the question, because the current law doesn't provide for financing for dispatch, only for call taking. But we all know that a lot of those are commingled, and that's how it's operated in most of the centers. So there's several key points that I think that we need to get guidance from the legislature on which direction you want us to go from this information that we've gathered. I think next gen is a no-brainer. It's a question of how big.
Would it be possible to receive a map of where those 49 PSAPs are located?
Yes, sir.
Would that be possible?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
And so our intention at this point is to, one, keep moving toward the next gen. Two, kind of develop the bullets that we believe that the legislature is going to need to decide upon as we start looking at how we frame the discussion for 2013 rewrite. And I think if we, and again, the policy committee, at least the Senate Veterans Committee, wants a play in this. So the question will be, I assume that we'll go there, here, you guys will work together. But my point is that we'll develop that list of due outs that has to occur. If you decide that you want to go to 9, you want to leave it at 48, or whatever the legislature decides, because that's what we got to have before we can really move the ball further.
Appreciate that. Well, you know, the one thing that I would share in this capacity is that I have a sensitivity to geography, and so as we move forward, that's something I would hope we would continue to visit about, is how does geography play into all this. So we appreciate you folks. John. Oh, Senator Berger.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're a Ways and Means Committee, and so that's what we'll be looking at. But I'd just like to interject something here, and that is that sometimes communities themselves, if they're well vetted and educated in certain things, will simply agree. Mm-hmm. And some regions. And I would really hate to see the legislature move forward in some kind of effort that just mandates and walks over and says this is the way it's going to be without giving communities themselves an opportunity to say our region, Eastern Oregon region, would like to get together, our coastal region, because we are going to certainly depend on 911. Hopefully it'll be operating if there's an earthquake or a tsunami. And it is not at all impossible that you might get a South Coast PSAP to simply agree, right? Absolutely. And so unless that conversation takes place, I just would be hesitant if I were the legislature to move forward without allowing public to have that say.
It'd be like the British dividing up the Middle East.
That's worked really well.
Great guidance. Yeah. John.
Really well.
Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
All right.
So moved.
All right. Representative Barker moves that we acknowledge receipt of a report on the relative merits of public safety answering point consolidation throughout the state with the intent of reducing redundancy and creating a more cost-efficient delivery system. That's quite a motion. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Berger, would you like to carry this?
I would. Yeah, I'll be happy to carry it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All righty. No other action before the committee. We're going to adjourn. John, appreciate